are your many bedchambers. You sleep in one. No place is yours where you yourselves are not. Next I pass to you. You, whose bottomless and insatiable maw explores on one hand the seas, on the other the earth, with enormous toil hunting down your prey, now with hook, now with snare, now with nets of various kinds. No animal has peace except when you are cloyed with it. And how slight a portion of those banquets of yours, prepared for you by so many hands, do you taste with your pleasure-jaded palate? How slight a portion of all that game, whose taking was fraught with danger, does the master's sick and squeamish stomach relish? How slight a portion of all those shellfish, imported from so far, slips down that insatiable gullet? Poor wretches, do you not know that your appetites are bigger than your bellies? Talk in this way to other men, provided that while you talk, you also listen. Write in this way, provided that while you write, you read, remembering that everything you hear or read is to be applied to conduct and to the alleviation of passion's fury. Study, not in order to add anything to your knowledge, but to make your knowledge better. Farewell. Letter 90. On the part played by philosophy in the progress of man. Who can doubt, my dear Lucilius, that life is the gift of the immortal gods, but that living well is the gift of philosophy? Hence the idea that our debt to philosophy is greater than our debt to the gods, in proportion as a good life is more of a benefit than mere life, would be regarded as correct, were not philosophy itself a boon which the gods have bestowed upon us. They have given the knowledge thereof to none, but the faculty of acquiring it they have given to all. For if they had made philosophy also a general good, and if we were gifted with understanding at our birth, wisdom would have lost her best attribute, that she is not one of the gifts of fortune. For, as it is, the precious and noble characteristic of wisdom is that she does not advance to meet us, that each man is indebted to himself for her, and that we do not seek her at the hands of others. What would there be in philosophy, worthy of your respect, if she were a thing that came by bounty? Her sole function is to discover the truth about things divine and things human. From her side, religion never departs, nor duty, nor justice, nor any of the whole company of virtues which cling together in close united fellowship. Philosophy has taught us to worship that which is divine, to love that which is human. She has told us that with the gods lies dominion, and among men, fellowship. This fellowship remained unspoiled for a long time, until avarice tore the community asunder and became the cause of poverty, even in the case of those whom she herself had most enriched. For men cease to possess all things the moment they desire all things for their own. But the first men, and those who sprang from them, still unspoiled, followed nature, having one man as both their leader and their law, entrusting themselves to the control of one better than themselves. for nature has the habit of subjecting the weaker to the stronger. Even among the dumb animals, those which are either biggest or fiercest hold sway. It is no weakling bull that leads the herd. It is one that has beaten the other males by his might and his muscle. In the case of elephants, the tallest goes first. Among men, the best is regarded as the highest. That is why it was to the mind that a ruler was assigned. And for that reason, the greatest happiness rested with those peoples among whom a man could not be the more powerful unless he were the better. For that man can safely accomplish what he will, who thinks he can do nothing except what he ought to do. Accordingly, in that age which is maintained to be the golden age, Posidonius holds that the government was under the jurisdiction of the wise. They kept their hands under control and protected the weaker from the stronger. They gave advice, both to do and not to do. They showed what was useful and what was useless. Their forethought provided that their subjects should lack nothing. Their bravery warded off dangers. Their kindness enriched and adorned their subjects. For them, ruling was a service, not an exercise of royalty. No ruler tried his power against those to whom he owed the beginnings of his power, and no one had the inclination or the excuse to do wrong, since the ruler ruled well, and the subject obeyed well, and the king could utter no greater threat against disobedient subjects than that they should depart from the kingdom. But when once vice stole in, and kingdoms were transformed into tyrannies, a need arose for laws, and these very laws were in turn framed by the wise. Solon, who established Athens upon a firm basis by just laws, was one of the seven men renowned for their wisdom. Had Lycurgus lived in the same period, an eighth would have been added to that hallowed number seven. The laws of Zaleucus and Charondas are praised. It was not in the forum or in the offices of skilled counselors, but in the silent and holy retreat of Pythagoras that these two